And then I'd ask that you please help me welcome Kelly B., our speaker tonight from Santa Barbara.
My name is Kelly Berger. I'm an alcoholic.
Kelly.
I want to thank Nate for giving me a call and asking me to come up and speak. It's always a privilege to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught to always say yes, although the words it was close. But it's been a very long time since I've been up here sharing my story. I hope you can get something from it. I'm not a big book thumper. I hang out with a whole lot of big book thumpers. My best friend will talk big book all day long until I have to hide in my room so he can't find me. It's always big book. but that best friend with the big book conversation day in, day out is a big part of my sobriety. So I'll tell you a story. Born and raised into an alcoholic family, mother and father both alcoholics, father more of an more alcoholic than mother, but she liked to, you know, get her drink on too. I was just telling somebody, we used to go to, my father had us take apart a bus. I was a little kid, two, three years old, took apart the bus, made it a motorhome, and we'd go to a bar restaurant in Ojai or Ventura, the Boots and Saddles. And we would have dinner and he'd put us kids in the back of the bus and we'd all go to sleep. And we knew we were on our way home because you could feel the reflectors as he drove home, because that's how he drove home. Smashed, but he knew if he was staying with on the reflectors, he was driving a fairly straight line. You know, so alcohol was very much part of my childhood from day one. At age 5, 6, he would let us, my brother and I, mix drinks for him and his business partners when they had meetings. I don't remember the effect of the alcohol, but I remember like playing bartender. And we just make all kinds of crazy stuff. But by the time I was 8, 9 years old, I knew how to make a Bloody Mary. I knew how to make a gin tonic. I knew how to make a screwdriver. and it was just a normal thing, you know, go down to the liquor store and get a big box of liquor and bring it home to my father with a couple cartons of cigarettes on a Saturday afternoon. And it was allowed, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old. Maybe even younger. But that type of lifestyle for my father brought him to his grave at a very young age, 47 years old. He died of alcoholism, untreated alcoholism. Although he had given many attempts, but never to put it all down in. Remember, at one point he was allowed to have 2 flasks of wine, 1 in the morning, 1 at night. But then he would have us refill the flask for him. So he had brain tumors. He died just before my 10th birthday. My mother, not in the position to raise 4 children on her own, never really had a driver's license, never really drove, never really had a job, but was forced out into the workforce trying to raise 4 kids that, delinquent might be the word for it. Especially my brother and I, we were just, you know, wherever I was, he was, wherever he was, I was, and it was usually getting in trouble. I had a little sister, Carrie, who was just lost. If you look into the dynamics of the family system, she was the lost child. And she ran about and did some things and ran away and got herself in some trouble. My brother and I both got ourselves in some trouble. And that way, you know, that period, it was about 5 years of just mayhem. And my mother finally decided, you know, we're going to be a family again. We're going to stop this nonsense. We're going to move to Ojai. You're going to do the agriculture. I was going to grow weed for her. She was going to be the green thumb and I was going to sell it. But to do that, I had to go back to school because I had dropped out of school by that point. And it was a plan. We had a bad plan. Probation said, as long as you move out of the county, we'll release your probation. They told my brother, as long as you do a weekend in county jail, we're gonna, in juvenile hall, we're gonna release you from your probation too. So So off to Lehi we went. We had the plan. My little sister Carrie, while she was having her problems, was pregnant at 12 years old, had her baby while we were in Ojai. I'll never forget, my brother and I were driving down Casitas Pass Road in Carpinteria, going back to Ojai, Christmas Eve, and my sister would say, all I want for Christmas is a tree. Okay. We pull over, he hops the fence, grab the tree, tied to the top of the car, and off we go. We go to home, she's happy, she's got Christmas tree, she wrote a construction paper IOUs to everybody, and that was our Christmas that year. It's about 2 weeks later, January 7, 1983, one night before my 15th birthday, a drunk driver killed my mother and sister. And there was, for me at that time, no coming back. I got what they call the fuckets, and I didn't care. I had already, by the time I was 13, we'll back up a little bit, was declared an alcoholic by the Santa Barbara County, and they were having me go to alcohol counseling, which I never went to, but they wanted me to, because they felt that I was alcoholic. I was drinking like an alcoholic, I can tell you that. So when 15 came along, alcohol kicked back in, along with other substances, at a very young age and very hard. It was a balls to the wall from 15 forward. About a year later, my brother had moved to New York. And while he went to New York, came back, my mother's cousin who took custody of me moved me to San Diego, said, you're gonna go to jail if you don't move away from everybody. So, 16-year-old kid in a hotel, night auditor with the master key to every room in the hotel. Bad idea. We had parties. I was jumping off the balcony and saying, you're going home to my mother. So I was sent to live with my mother's aunt, my great aunt, who was a drill sergeant. So I made a friend real quick around the corner. I'm over at his house. Before I went, she said, you need to be home for dinner. It's at 5 o'clock. Okay. 3 minutes to five. Hey, I gotta go home. Dinner's at five. I walked in the door at 5:05 and sat down at the table, and everybody, what are you doing? I said, dinner. Dinner was at five. You're all eating. Yeah, you could stay, but you're not gonna get any food. Maybe tomorrow you'll be here at 5 o'clock. And I hated it. But at that time, it was exactly what I needed. It was exactly what I needed. I stopped drinking. I was partaking in some other things, but I wasn't drinking. And I got dropped back into high school. I got my high school diploma. And things started to look okay for a little while. And it was the 80s, and Scarface came out. So there's some Scarface behaviors in there, night clubbing. I knew the guy, a friend of mine, his older brothers owned a music studio, so I was engulfed in that along with my brother. It was just crazy. My brother got in some trouble. He moved back to California. I stayed in New York, and I did fairly well for 8-9 years. Fueled with a cocaine addiction. A lot of people used to drink alcohol, do a little bit of cocaine to keep the alcohol going. I used to drink a lot of alcohol to tone down the cocaine. I had a remedy where, by the end of the night, I'd just pull it, two of these filled with vodka, drink them down and go to sleep if I could. That didn't, pan out. I wound up moving out to California. Did the, I'm going to relocate and I'm going to get sober. That didn't work. Started getting into other things, still drinking. I think I had my last drink in 2005, but I kept going with other things and got myself in trouble. got together with me and my brother again, and got ourselves in trouble. And while I was getting in that trouble, I was going to county jail. And when, I'll back up a little bit, I was afraid I was going to be scattered. When the man who had, the gentleman who had killed my mother and sister in the drunk driving accident was sentenced, from what I remember as a child, he was given a sentence, but he was granted a credit time served, suspended sentence. In reality, he did a bunch of probation in 90 days in county jail. And what helped him with that was that he went to an AA meeting, and he did exactly what I'm doing right now. He spoke to the meeting, they recorded the meeting, played it at his sentencing, and you know, of course, he was talking about how remorseful he was. So they were extremely lenient with him. There was also a police officer, so that helped him as well. But for a 15-year-old kid, what that told me was, if you get in trouble, go to AA, and you won't go to prison. So that was my thing, you know. When I got to county jail, I'd start doing the STP programs, I'd go to AA, got one of the people in STP to allow me to have a morning meeting at 9 o'clock in the library, and then I convinced her to give me cards, sign-in cards. And I would sell those cards because I didn't have anything coming. I didn't have any money coming in on my books. I would sell those cards for coffee. I look back now and I'd say that was my first experience with H&I. A little twisted, but yeah. In and out, in and out, in and out. Finally went to prison. And I came out of prison, and when I went into prison, it was, I'm going to go in, I'm going to clean myself up, I'm going to find my brother Rob when I get out, and I'm going to be in a position where I can be a benefit to the family, because I can't do this anymore. I went in, I did my entire term sober. I was holding the methamphetamine, the cigarettes, the cell phones, and all that for the Spanish people, because I couldn't stand smelling their asses every morning when I woke up. Give it to me, I'll hold it for you, it's okay. And I did that for, you know, 19 months, 18 months, whatever it was. And the night I was supposed to leave, we were doing the green dot, and we were, give me some of that, and did a little bit of methamphetamine, did a little bit of vodka or whatever it was he had, and stayed up all night looking out the window watching the tree. I had everybody convinced that the goon squad was ready to raid the building. So we were all posted at the window. It was trees, garbage pails, and bushes. Not one of them was a CO. But I didn't get to go home. They kept me another 2 weeks. And I came home on the bus loaded. I got off the bus loaded. And I ran amok for 2-3 months. But I noticed there was a common denominator with me getting loaded. I was miserable. I was more miserable when I was loaded than I was sober. And I kept going to jail. Get high, miserable, go to jail. Get out of jail, get high, get miserable, go back to jail. I'm fairly, like to think I'm a little intelligent up there. So I stopped, gave everything away, I'm sober. But now I'm absconding and I have a warrant out for my arrest. So I decided I'm gonna live in the bushes and make the best of it, because this is what I have. This is the best I can do for myself. And I lived in those bushes for about 5.5 months sober. And somebody who was with me decided it would be a good idea to sunbathe next to the railroad tracks. So they came and they, what are you doing? We'll give you 48 hours to get out of here. Sure, we don't know who you are. I gave them my brother's name. They're like, well, where's your brother? Well, he's in New York. Okay. Well, they came back 48 hours later and they found me. And one of the officers decided it'd be a good thing to take a picture of me. So I told whoever it was, it's like, when they come back, I'm in the tent. Just let them know where I'm at. And they came back and they arrested me. And I'm thinking I'm going to prison. You know, I've been absconding for 6-7 months. And here we go, we're going back to prison. And they called my parole officer, probation officer, and he said, yeah, give him the flash. Flash him for 9 days. I said, excuse me, officer, did you just say 9 days? He's like, so I'm going to county jail for 9 days? So yeah, I thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I was living in a damn bush for 4.5 months, thinking I'm going to prison, and here, going to county jail for 9 days. I've done a lot of time in county jail. Those 9 days were the worst 9 days of time I had ever done. And there was a common factor. I was sober. The one and only time I had been in county jail sober. There was no detoxing to acclimate to my surroundings. It sucked the minute I got there, and it sucked for every minute I was in there. So I got out, and I decided I was going to do some things different. And I wasn't going to go back to the camp, and I wasn't going to go around where anybody was doing any drugs or anything stupid. And there was a bunch of signs, not like street signs or writing on the wall, but just situational things. Walking down the street, I'm going to go there, some kind of situation. Maybe I'll go this way, or maybe I should do this, or maybe I'm going to do that. And for a week, that happened, walking around aimlessly. And a girlfriend of mine who wouldn't put a red penny on my books promised me a letter once a month for the time that I was away. Finally said, hey, looks like you're doing pretty good. Why don't I send you some money? I'm like, okay. She gave me the money, and for the first 2 minutes in my hand, I can go to the dope guy. I got money. I could. And it's like, you know what? That'd be completely disrespectful and going the wrong way. And I went to the bridge of where I used to sleep underneath the freeway, and I just realized this the other day, that I gave what I call my higher power an ultimatum. And that's either you're going to get me out of this mess, or I'm going to go right back to doing what I was doing. So the next day I had to check into probation, checked in with probation, and he said, well, we got a bed for you over at a sober living if you're willing to go. It's like, really? It's like, yeah, we'll pay your rent for 90 days. Okay, he's like, and by the way, put this GPS on your ankle so we know where you are. If you choose not to go to that sober living, at least we know where you are. Okay. So I'm walking this sober living, and I'm realizing, you know, this is it. I'm never going to have the opportunity to get loaded again. So I stopped down on State Street and walked into a bar. I looked at the bartender and I said, barkeep, I want you to put down 15 shots of your best whiskey as quickly as you can. And he did. He lined them all up, and as quick as he could put them down, I drank them. He looked at me, he was like, my God, what's the matter? I said, well, if you had what I had, you'd be drinking these shots pretty quick too. He looked at me and said, well, what do you have? I said, $3. That's not mine. That's a very good friend of mine, very integral part of my recovery, Tim Wickham. I'm going to give him credit two more times, and it will be mine. I love that joke. As a counselor, I would tell that to my group room. So anyways, I do go to the sober living. And, you know, for me, it's like, this is a hustle. I'm going to do this until the wheels fall off. I'm going to make it work for as long as I can make it work. And I get there, and you got to go to AA, and you got to do this, and you got to do that. And I'm like, oh, fuck, really? But I looked at the bed, and it was like one of the most inviting things I had ever seen in many, many years. It was a regular bed, regular pillow, used blankets and sheets, but I didn't care about that. You know, you're living in a tent. Any sheet is good. So I did it, and I made the commitment to follow the rules of what they had and do what I had to do. But then, you know, outside there was no place to sit. At this one little rinky-dink table, and that was it. In this big yard, and a bunch of people. And I was leaving the property, and I saw 6 wooden chairs on the corner, like dining room chairs. So I brought them back to the property. About 4 days later, this guy comes in, buzz cut, big old blockhead, He's like, who are you? And I tell him, I introduce myself. And he's like, okay. He's like, where are these chairs? He's like, I brought them. Thinking I did something good, I was adding to the property. He's like, oh, get those chairs the hell off my property. Why? He's like, because when you relapse, not only am I going to have to throw all your crap away, but I'm going to have to haul those chairs out of here. So why don't you get them out of here for me? And that set a seed in me. Like, you got me messed up. I'm not going to relapse. I'm going to show you. So I started following him around. He'd pull up to pick up his brother for a meeting, and I'd jump in the back of his truck. Where are we going? And sit at book studies across from him. Sober. I go to his home group. Sober. What I didn't realize then was by me showing him, he showed me. And, you know, he started talking 12-step to me. There was a period of going to meetings that it didn't matter what meeting it was that I had followed him to. The topic of that meeting was something I was struggling with in that moment. And I was hearing experiences from 30, 40. At one meeting, there was like 80, 90 people at that meeting. And I was starting to hear experience that told me, well, if this guy can do it, maybe I got a chance. So I started to give AA a little bit more of a chance. And then, you know, I was hell-bent on proving that it doesn't work. People go to AA to not go to jail. That's what you do. But I continued going to meetings, and you had to have a sponsor. So I called my friend Stevie, who's in the music industry, and he was doing some work with Linkin Park. And I said, hey, Stevie, anybody calls you, you're my sponsor. He's like, okay, but read the first 64 pages, all right? Like, yeah, okay, Stevie, whatever. Just if anybody calls you, you're my sponsor. He's like, okay. About a week later, the meeting topic at Men Without Legs, which at one time was my home group, the meeting was about sponsorship. Another thing I should say, my brother will relate to it. I was exposed to a telemarketing room for about 4 years of some of the best telemarketers in LA County. And I was going to these AA meetings and I'm listening to people's pitches, and I'm like, you wouldn't make a dollar. You'd do pretty good. You would just stay away from the sales room altogether. But, it, you know, in the beginning, my naive mind was, these are just sales pitches. These are just sales pitches. They're trying to convince me of something to buy into. And I know the telemarketing game. But then, you know, I heard about sponsorship and how one guy said, he's like, you know, I was hell-bent that I'm going to go through this thing and I am not going to get a sponsor, and I'm going to show everybody that it can be done without having a sponsor, and I'm not going to do the steps. Then he went on to talk about a life of relapse, and then talked about having some time because he got a sponsor and he worked the steps. And we're leaving the meeting, and my buddy, by the way, who's your sponsor? His name's Stefano Di Benedetto. I said, been in the sobriety. He's like, I've been in the recovery area for a while now. I don't think I've ever heard of a Stefano Di Benedetto. What's his number? Well, it's 516. He says, stop right there. You're going to get an 805 or you're going to get out of my house. I was like, damn it. So I got me an 805 sponsor. It was kind of like the blind leading the blind. You could barely read. But he took the time, and he gave me reading assignments, and I did the reading, and he'd come over, and he'd explain it to me to the best of his ability. And I would kind of get it, kind of not. You know, I was told, and this was step three, give our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Okay, I'll give you my will, I'll give you my life, we're going to get. Not till many years later did I understand what was being said there. But I went with it, and we got to the fourth step. And this fourth step is probably one of the main reasons why I brought the bit with my little sister and mother. And, you know, column one, who was it? The guy who killed my mother and sister. What did he do? He killed my mother and sister. How did it affect you? Well, it affected me this way, that way, the other way. Fueled 35, 30 years of addiction. And then the fourth column, What was your part? Miss me. That was my answer. I looked at my sponsor, I got really mad. I went, miss me. My part? My part in that idiot getting in a car and going out and mowing down my mother and sister drunk? What's my part? Are you kidding me? And for about 3 or 4 months, that was my stance. No, I had no part in that. And I go to meetings and I keep doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and everybody, my buddy Tim, like, dude, well, dude, you gotta get past that. You gotta look it for, you gotta do that fourth column. Nothing's gonna change. My buddy Steve always telling me, hey, nothing changes if nothing changes. I just thought it was some stupid joke he had. I was in the Iwana Club and I was paying attention to what all we did. There was nothing else to do but listen. And somebody had shared, and they talked about, you know, nothing changes if nothing changes. And I realized it wasn't a stupid joke. He was telling me, you know, nothing changes, and what he was talking about was my thinking. Nothing was going to change. So I was working on changing my thinking, and I went to another meeting at the Iwana Club, and I can't for the life of me remember what it was said. But whatever it was, opened the lights, and I realized what my part was. And it was a whole bunch of ill will and hatred that I carried in myself for the man who killed my mother and sister. And the only way to get past that was to forgive it. So I had to sit and talk to myself logically. Was he alcoholic? Yes. Is alcoholism a disease? Yes. Did he purposely get in a motor vehicle, hunt down my mother and sister, and run them off the road? Absolutely not. Did he have any real control in that? Absolutely not. You know, I've learned that the minute that you put a substance into your body that alters your mind, you are no longer capable of making an informed decision. And anything that comes after that is coming after that based on an inebriated mind, a mind that is no longer capable of thinking rationally. And having that, and that little, you know, can't argue. Another thing that I've learned was you can't argue with right. And I couldn't argue with it because it was right. And having that little bit of willingness, some would say open mind, I was able to figure that out and figure out what my part was and get into the fourth step and finish my fourth step. And, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, they come quickly. I was making my amends. 10, 11, 12, 12, some will argue I'm not doing it. And I think maybe I might in my own little way. But I did what I was asked. And another thing, I'll go back a little bit, is they tell you in Alcoholics Anonymous is find somebody who's got what you want. Find somebody who's living a life that you'd like to live, and then do what they do. So I did that. I found that idiot. I had to follow around to the, you know, I'm still sober. And by the way, I'm still sober. And I call him idiot, other words, but I promise to not to use profanity here. He's now my best friend. I don't have a friend closer than that guy that, you know, at the beginning it was just, I'm going to show him. He took his time. Every day he would come to that house. Come on, we got work to do. Really? I just want to lay here in my bed. Ooh, we got work to do. And he'd take me around, drive me around in a truck and talk big book, and maybe we would change a light bulb at one of the houses or something, and that was the work for the day. But he did that for a very long time. My probation that was going to pay my rent for 90 days told me, you keep doing what you're doing and we're going to keep doing what we're doing. And they allowed me to take a year off from life and work a 12-step program, go to the meetings, work with my sponsor, work with the crew of guys I had, go to retreats and, you know, get from other people from all over you know, mid-Southern California, these people would come and they'd share their experience, strength, and hope with me. And it just fueled me. Like, this is, you know, this is what I got to do. I continued to take direction. I was told, you know, hey, if, you know, as long as you're doing what you're doing and you remain willing, Stalwart, which was the name of the sober living I went to, will always take care of you. Just do what you got to do. And yeah, so yeah, so that's not a bad offer. Probation going to pay my rent. Stalwart's going to take care of me. Go to school. Fuck, go to school. I went to school, started going to school. One semester, one class per semester. Then, you know, my life started to get better. I got a job. I started working as the manager for that sober living. Some old behaviors came in, and I got fired from that sober living. And then some time passed, and some growth came, and I got rehired to that sober living. And, you know, time passed, and I got, you know, what do you say? Life happened again, and I got mad. And you could say it was a resentment. And I quit that sober living in about a year. And that was a very pivotal time in my life because all of my sobriety up till that point was based on sober living and 12-step, going to meetings, hanging out with the crew, and doing what they did. But now I'm on my own. I got to pay my rent, and I got to do the right thing, and I need to stay sober doing it. And I was able to do that for a year. It was like no effort at all. Just do what you do. I just started working in a recovery office as a pee tester. Things were going good. I was going somewhere. Like a butterfly. Seriously. But, you know, so I started doing the sober living thing and started managing the sober living thing. I had a guy call me up and, you know, we got an opportunity for the counselor. I was like, well, I got to school. And, you know, I went down to Project Recovery in Santa Barbara and I applied for a counselor position. And they interviewed me for the pee tester. And they asked me a bunch of professional questions in an interview. What kind of arsenal is this? I don't know the answers to these questions. What are you really asking me, by the way? Can you dumb that down a little for me? But I answered the best questions to the best of my ability, walked out of the building, called my girlfriend in New York and said, I tanked that interview. She's like, what? I was like, they asked me questions that I've never had before. I didn't know how to answer them. And she's like, that's all right. You got your feet wet. You're going to be okay. Half hour later, Kelly, we're going to give you the job. You guys are smoked out. Okay. But I got that job, and I worked for 3 weeks, and they laid me off because their census dropped. And, you know, I tell you this because there's ups and downs in that. And within all these ups and downs, not once did having a drink or doing a line of cocaine or whatever might get down at the time. Not once did that come to mind or come to be something that was appealing to me. There was no desire, it was gone. And I relate that to the step work that I did and the people that I was with. They taught me how to remove that desire from my life. So I went through all that. And then this little guy, Pat, everybody hated him, but I loved him because he was always super nice to me, always welcoming. And came in, he's like, you're going to be a counselor. Get your shit together. What do I need? You need this, you need that, and you need a county ID number by February. This was December, the end of December. I'm like, okay. So I scrambled and I did everything he asked me to do. And in February, he made me a counselor. Retired a year later. But what I didn't realize is that he was slowly training me on the side, and I learned what he was doing when he retired. So I climbed the ladder through the company, became program manager, but within that, get back to where how Alcoholics Anonymous has really taught me how to go through some things in life. I had a pain in my side. I'm not going to the doctor. Finally go to the doctor. It's appendicitis. Your appendix about to blow up. You need to go to the hospital. And by the way, there's a growth on your liver. You might want to have that looked at. Okay, great. So I go. They pull the appendix out. They look at the liver, send me to a liver doctor, and he's like, a kidney doctor. He's like, yeah, so you got a growth on your kidney. We're not going to do any kind of anything. We're just going to take it out because 99.9% of the time it's cancer. Okay, great. Can you do it before January so I don't have to pay coinsurance again? Sure. So in October, I went, I had my appendix taken out. In December, 2 months to the day, they took out my left kidney. And not once in all of that, and they told me I had to start walking and stop smoking. I told him, yeah, when he told me, hey, yeah, you're going to have to stop smoking and you're going to have to start walking, I told him, Saturday, today, start today. But I did that. I haven't smoked in 2 years. Having the kidney come out and what have you, not once did drinking or using drugs or anything become, you know, like anything like a good idea, or not even the thought to do it, to get past it. So Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life of freedom, real freedom from the desire to drink or use drugs or alcohol. I don't know, I hope you all got something from what I said. I can't believe time ran out. Grateful for my life today, grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for my good friend over here who I kind of bashed in the beginning, but I have nothing but a whole lot of love for him and how he's helped me through my life. Thank you. Kelly Berger, Alcoholic, Part 2.
You're back.
They didn't catch the meeting ended at 8:30. I'd ask them not to stop me sooner. But, within my rambling, I had left out some really important information. While I drove around in the truck with my buddy Steve, he one day told me, he's like, hey, you know what you need to do? You need to join H&I. I was like, really? I said, yeah. 87% of people who do H&I stay sober. Well, that's a good odds. When's the next meeting? So I'll pick you up. So he picks me up for the next business meeting. I go to the business meeting, and you know, all of my crew are, you know, way into this neck deep into H&I. They all got commitments. They're doing all kinds of stuff. And the chair is like, I want to thank everybody for coming. I want you to know that 80% of the people that do H&I stay sober. So I was like, wow, we lost somebody? 87%, now we're at 80. And my good friend Tim, he said, I want you all to know that 80% of all percentages are made up. I'm like, okay, he got me again. Trick recovery. But I got involved with H&I, and it was and still is a very good part of my recovery. And another part of that, which kind of ties H&I in, is my brother, who, when I went to state prison, went to federal prison because he didn't stop when I got arrested. He went and did a bunch of knucklehead stuff. And I wasn't there to say, hey, that's a bad idea. So when, you know, I did my term, I told you I wanted to do my term, get out, find my brother, and be useful. So I found him, and luckily for me, he was right there in Lompoc. So I would drive from Santa Barbara, and I would go up and I'd get to visit him. You know, first couple of years, he didn't have any visitors. So for me to visit him, it was good. And he's looking at me, he's like, you're sober? And I went up, he's like, you got teeth? Believe it or not, you know, if you stay sober long enough, your teeth will grow back in this program. But he's like, I can't believe you're sober. I can't believe you're really doing it. What's going on? It's like, yeah, it's, you know, AA, it's actually, it works. I did a sober living thing, I'm working in sober living, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And from only being able to go up once every 2 or 3 months, I was able to afford a car. I'd start saving $20 a week, and I was a big guy. But, you know, 220 turned into 200. Bought a car, and I was going up every other weekend. And finally, you know, got him to the point where he was asking questions about Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, well, my friends, they come up here, and they do a H&I panel here. Why don't you sign up? And he had that little bit of willingness to say, okay. So I told my buddies that were going up there, hey, my brother's gonna go, look out for him. He's the only guy there who can't hear. My brother was in prison, deaf. So my good friend Steve would go up there and they would work with him and they'd write things down for him, which encouraged him to stay with it and start looking at things in a different way. And, you know, he had already made the decision he was going to drink or use once you know, got arrested or what have you. But he did expose himself to AA. He did go from, you know, panels, H&I. When he went to a different state, he continued to do that. I got a ninth step amends from him in an email, because you can email from prison. And fortunately, he's here, right here today. Sober. God is with that. So that was the plug I wanted to make. I wanted to make sure that everybody heard that, you know, H&I is a huge part of recovery for me and many, many others. So if you're not involved with H&I, please get involved and see what you can do to help another person. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. How about we give him another round of applause?